You know, the Ottoman Empire, it's we're starting this thing. I don't know what to call it. It's sort of like the Islamic world confronts imperialism, or the Islamic world and imperialism, because, you know, we're talking about the Ottoman Empire, and it seems to me that the Ottoman Empire is so important in terms of the whole construct of, like, Western civilization. Like, when you're saying Western civilization in the 19th century onward, or even earlier, 1700s maybe, you're thinking about the East, and the East that you have the most contact with, that you're always, you know, seeing as a foil, is the Ottoman Empire, right?
Yeah, plus it's multinational. So in a sense, this is the history of, you know, Syria, Jordan.
Yeah, right.
Lebanon. And parts of other countries, as well as what we look at as modern Turkey.
And then you were saying, last episode, you were saying, like, is Russia part of Europe or part of Asia? And the Ottoman Empire and Turkey is definitely that same, falls right in that ambiguous window too, right?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause Europe, if Europe is Christian, and, well, the Turkey is Muslim, if Europe is, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's not just Europe? The Middle East. I mean, the history of the Ottoman Empire is totally intertwined with Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, Serbia, you know, and so on.
Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
So the other thing is, as I was saying, I was reading a lot of Isa Blumi, who's he's a scholar. I think he's based in Sweden, but he himself has kind of like a multinational background. His ethnic background is like part Albanian on one side, and he, you know, moved around a lot when he was young, and
mm-hmm.
So he's a scholar of the Ottoman Empire. He's got these books, Ottoman Refugees, 1878 to 1939, and Foundations of Modernity. He writes a lot about Yemen, really good stuff about the contemporary Yemen situation.
Yeah, and I read a more modern history of the Ottoman Sultans by a guy who identifies himself as, you know, half Bulgarian, half Arab, and really, really makes the case that the Ottoman Empire is Ottoman and not Turkish.
Yeah, because Turkish is basically what happens at the end.
Right.
And Blumi, he says something about, you know, you can't just, the mistake that people make when they're studying the history of the Ottoman Empire is they have like this frame of decline.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, the framework of decline is like, it's such a big framework that you can kind of fit everything into it, but that also means that you don't, it ends up explaining less than you want.
It's a tag, it's classification, just as we talked about in the episodes on, you know, science and racism. It's the application of a tag, and that seems to obviate the need to do any thinking. Oh, well, you know, decline, that's it. Or the phrase, the sick man of Europe.
Right.
So there's this attitude that after the siege of Vienna in 1689, which failed, that the Ottoman Empire is like the tide going back out.
Yeah.
And it's perpetual decline, gradual decline from then on. Which, is it?
He has this thing, yeah, there's a line I've been, it's somewhere, I'm trying to find it. It's like the backward, yeah, the collective suffering of quote unquote our ancestors initiates a historic process deemed necessary to productively quote unquote break from a pre-modern past. He's doing a lot of scare quotes. And he says, that is to say, the historically inevitable violent collapse of the pre-modern multi-ethnic empire helps the nation shed its backward oriental past and in turn permits it to become a part of the modern world. So he's basically saying, you know, there's a story that for modernity to come in, you know, the Ottoman Empire basically had to collapse. Right.
Interesting.
And he's not, that's not his argument. He's
no, I know. Yeah. He's yeah.
So
before we started this episode, I was thinking of us as sort of historical doctors. We're going to take a look at the sick man and possibly give a second opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when I, you know, the thing is, I really wanted to, you know, just say this whole decline thing is wrong, but it, you know, when you're talking about after the mid 18th century, the 1750s on, in relative terms, compared to the powers that, you know, it previously was more than capable of standing up to or standing alongside, there was a decline. So if you look at the wars with Russia, which we're going to look at in this episode, if you look at, you know, the relationship with the British Empire, you know, there was definitely a decline. And that's why this whole Islamic, this whole Islam and the Empires series of the next three, whether Ottomans, the Persian Empire, the Afghan Empire, they're all trying to modernize. And, you know, modernization in this context means very specifically, you know, trying to catch up economically and militarily so that you don't get overrun by the European empires, British Empire, but also in these cases, the Russian Empire, which is
also very interesting because the Russians had to westernize and modernize to catch up.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's this shockwave of modernization, which I guess is radiating out from the period we covered in our very early episodes, like the French, you know, the Louis the 14th was a modernizer, right? These greats, the greats that we talked about, the you know, and then the British, the French Revolution, the British various things they were doing industrially and with capitalism. So yeah, it's you know, modern in the sense that these empires, these Islamic, you know, empires are trying to work out a way to be modern so that they don't get defeated by those who have modernized a little bit before.
Yeah, so in a sense it's the same problem as we studied with China and Japan and India.
Yeah.
Only they've got a different domestic situation to deal with.
Right.
So you wanted to start by saying that you don't think there was a decline, but there was.
Yes, in my definitive, you know, clear way, I guess that's what I wanted to say. But the decline, listen, the decline was later than most people say it was, and it was less comprehensive than most people think it was. So.
And I would argue that it was not consistent. It's not a steady decline either. Mm-hmm. So, for example, shortly after the siege of Vienna, they had a war with Peter the Great of Russia in 1696, and they lost Azov in the Crimea. But in 1710 and 11, they had another war with Russia, defeated the Russians heavily, and got Azov back. And then you have a series of wars. I mean, that's the history of the Ottoman Empire, war after war. They had seven wars against Venice, and the Ottomans won six of them. The last was in 1716, 1718.
Is it possible, Dave, that I've heard or read an argument that Venice was basically a dependency of the Ottoman Empire? Is that a case somebody may have made, or is that something I must have misread?
I wouldn't call them a dependency. What I would say was that Venice's prosperity depended on their relationship with the Ottomans. Their whole trade, all their energies were oriented in that direction. Right. But the Ottomans ended up, in many cases, fighting simultaneous wars. And that's not easy for anybody. They fought Russia and the Habsburgs at the same time on multiple occasions, like in 1735 to 1739. And they lost Azov again to Russia. But at the same time, they regained Belgrade, northern Bosnia, and the Banat, a chunk of Transylvania. So they lost to Russia, but they beat the Habsburgs while fighting both at the same time. The big defeat of this period is another Russo-Turkish war, this one in 1768 to 1774. And again, they're fighting Russia while simultaneously dealing with a major revolt in Greece and a Mamluk usurper in Egypt. So they're at war on five fronts at the same time. This defeat led to the Treaty of Kuchuk-Kenarka, and the Crimea was declared independent. Not for long. Russia annexed it in 1782. They had to pay war reparations. I found that interesting. War reparations wasn't necessarily that modern of an invention. They had to pay 4.5 million rubles, and they also surrendered territory between the Dnieper and Bug rivers. But the dangerous, dangerous piece of that treaty was Russia being recognized as the protector of Orthodox Christians in the Ottoman Empire. Yeah. Basically, this is a pretext for war whenever Russia likes. They can just say, oh, you are abusing Orthodox Christians, so war.
And then we will start to see later in this episode and in history how the French and the English get in on this game too, and everybody's protecting some or other minority in the
And it's Ottoman really Empire. Ironic because for centuries, the Ottoman treatment of minority religions was, I don't know if I want to say exemplary, but it was sure a hell of a lot better than anywhere else in the world I can think of.
Well, yeah, or when you think of like, how about a reciprocal relationship where the Ottomans then become the protectors of Muslims in England? Oh, wait, England doesn't have any Muslims. Don't be ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. Right. The treatment of Jews, the treatment of Christians of whatever denomination, pretty darn good.
It was under a legal framework, whatever. We'll talk about it more later.
Okay.
So one last point about this decline thing. Hodgson, in a book called Rethinking World History, he says, a Westernist image of world history, if not disciplined by a more adequate perspective, can do untold harm. In fact, it is now doing untold harm. That is why I lay so much stress on not assuming decadence in Islamic society before the 18th century, unless one has really good evidence. So it's like, again, you know, decadence, decline, all these kinds of frames that
suggest an internal problem.
Yeah, and like you were saying, like a continuous problem. Like it's just, you know, they conquered Constantinople and then they've been declining ever since, you know.
Yeah.
600 years of decline or whatever. We were just talking about Venice and the Ottoman Empire, and Gunder Frank, the book Reorient that I mentioned over the past few episodes, he was talking about where the Ottomans fit in the world economy. So the fact that they're at the crossroads between Europe and Asia, that they end up in control of the trade in spices and silk. So that's like, a very, very big deal, especially before the, 1500s and before the, even up until the Suez Canal, you got to go through there to get those things. So if you want to go overland, you know, basically they're in the way. So Istanbul was the largest city in Europe for quite some time with, 600,000 to 750,000 people. There were other Cairo, Aleppo, and other cities were equally, or if not equally, but close to as big and as rich. So, a pattern that I've been noticing researching these episodes is like there are a lot of these powerful tribal groups in Central Asia, and they're, wildly, one of them will be wildly successful, and then they'll end up like taking over the whole thing. Like that's what the Ottomans were. If you watch this, I don't know, gazillion episode series on Netflix called Ertugrul, it's about the rise of the Ottoman Empire in, I guess, the 1300s, or, you know, it's like goes way back. So they're fighting, you know, the Seljuk Turks and the Mongols and the Crusaders. There's all those are all the bad guys.
And Timur.
But so in the East, they early on, they were rivals with these Mamluks in Egypt and in Syria. And the Ottomans kind of took over their business interests. And then they were kind of rivals with the Safavids in Persia. The Arab world, if you want to call it that, was probably about 30 million people until the late 18th century, until the late 1700s. And Baghdad was a key point on the Persian Gulf route. Cairo was the key point on the Red Sea route. And then Aden in present-day Yemen was the key on the Indian Ocean, which, and Aden was taken by the British in the 1840s, I think, 1830s mm-hmm. or 40s. So now here's another thing we should just dispel, which is the idea that, you know, because the Ottomans were Islamic and, you know, Europe was Christian, that there's like an eternal, you know, that the eternal conflict between Islam and Christianity, the clash of civilizations, as Samuel Huntington put it, you know, was like the eternal historical driving force here. In fact, you know, Shah Abbas, one of these Ottoman sultans. Oh no, Shah Abbas, I think, is in Persia.
Persia
made allies in Christian Europe against the Ottomans. The Ottomans allied with the Portuguese. The Portuguese sometimes allied with the Persians again against the Ottomans.
Yep.
At one point, Charles the 12th of Sweden, and it took refuge with the Ottomans.
They were both fighting Russia. And the Ottomans were frequently allied with France against the Habsburgs and against Spain.
Yeah.
And most of the Ottoman army were recruited from the Christian population of the Ottoman Empire.
Right. The Eastern Europe. So there's an interesting note by Michael Hudson. I really like Michael Hudson's economics. And he's written some ancient history as well. He's mainly focused on the question of debt, you know, like how it works and how debt and credit work and why the US, you know, why the current imperial system is so disastrous, you know, the power of the banks and stuff like that. But he talks about how he actually credits the sack of Constantinople in 1204 by the Crusaders and the gold that they sent back to Europe as having sparked the creation of the banking system in Europe. So it's interesting. Anyway, I read a book, so basically, the rise of the Ottomans, I guess, is credited to this period, you know, 1300s, because Constantinople never really recovered. Carolyn Finkel argues that it never really recovered and was fighting off these various Turkish tribes until one of them, namely the Ottomans, ended up, you know, winning, taking it over. Another thing about the Ottoman relationship to Europe is, you know, the scientific and engineering and technological connections, because there were, you know, it was, you could definitely consider it to be part of the European system in terms of that element. So, you know, as far as observations of astronomical observations, you know, we talked about Tycho Brahe and Copernicus, but there was the Istanbul Observatory, which was destroyed in 1580 for political reasons. But there was a person, Taqi ad-Din, who worked on clocks and astronomical calculations, and apparently had better observations than Tycho Brahe, who was the big They developed a steam turbine in 1551. There's famous architects. So that kind of like innovation, science thing that we talk about with the scientific revolution, like in a lot of ways the Ottomans were just a part of this, like a seamless part of it. It wasn't, they didn't start to fall behind until much later. So speaking of them falling behind, so by the late 1700s, they are starting to catch on that they are falling behind, and they're trying to figure out how to do this thing called modernization. So there's one of the important early modernizers, or like people who were trying to modernize, was this envoy of Sultan Mustafa named Ahmed Resmi. And in 1763-4, he visited Frederick the Great in Prussia. So Frederick the great military modernizer, right? And he wrote this. He wrote, "Night and day he reads the exploits of rulers of the past, such as the great Alexander and Timur. He stays far from the troubles and frustrations of his family and does not get involved in matters of religion and creed. All his thoughts and deeds are confined to and expended in pushing back the frontiers of his domains and winning glory and fame." So that's kind of like, oh, isn't he great? But it's also like, oh, don't our leaders suck? It's one of those ways of praising somebody else to.
Yeah, it's a pretty good analysis of Frederick, too.
Frederick the Great eats all his vegetables.
No, but he stays far from the troubles and frustrations of his family. Yeah, okay.
Like he doesn't talk to his family?
Doesn't talk to his wife? Yeah.
Yeah, that was a virtue back then. So Sultan Mustafa takes this seriously. He founds the Istanbul Technical University in 1773 with the Naval Engineer School and military training. But there, you know, the theme that keeps coming out in histories of the Ottomans in, you know, from the 1700s on, is that their financial system is not on point compared to what the British, and especially the British, are able to do, but even maybe the Russians, I don't know. They use tax farming and they're borrowing money from Europe. So that system of, Europe gets the gold from pillaging the Americas, and then, gold and silver, and then there's that whole engine we described with pumping silver into China and China driving, manufacture and the industrial system back then. So yeah. What's going on here is the Ottomans similarly are now, because of all the wars that they're fighting, because of their immense land frontier, they are borrowing gold from European financiers to finance wars, which come due, and they are constantly trying to reorganize their tax system to pay these loans, which eventually...
I'm wondering if some of our listeners aren't necessarily familiar with the term tax farming. Forgive me for the short explanation, but tax farming is a system of contracts. So you don't have tax collectors, you give the contract. So someone makes a bid, give me this area and I will collect 2 million for you. And the ruler says, sold. So that tax farmer now goes to that area to collect taxes. And of course, they don't want to collect 2 million. They want to collect 3 million. Because everything over 2 million that they squeeze out of that area belongs to them.
Yeah.
So the benefit for the ruler is you get a guaranteed sum of money. Of course, it's horrible for the people because you're always getting squeezed harder. And it's also not particularly efficient. So what you see in the growth of many modern states is when they switch from tax farming to a more efficient royal bureaucracy that gets a much higher portion of the taxes back into the king's or the ruler's purse.
Must have been good when they did it, right? I guess it's the alternative to just pure feudal dependence on the nobles or something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. unfortunately, the tax farmers subcontract.
Yeah.
And then they subcontract. So you're being squeezed by this whole chain of people that want to make a profit on the collection of taxes. It hurts the country, sorry, in the long run. But you're right. The big picture here is that the Ottomans are continually at war.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous. We'll get into some of these wars later on. But you simply cannot fight that many wars so constantly without running into serious trouble. And their incomes are declining. I shouldn't use that word, perhaps, but they are. From the big picture, again, the Silk Road is not the most profitable route anymore. The Europeans have gone around it. And this is obviously the 1700s. This is the British getting their feet in India. And trading with China. So, Constantinople is no longer the financial center of trade between East and West. And that's hurting the revenues of the Ottoman sultans. Their economic systems are a little outdated. So are their military. They came up with a system in the late 14th century called the Devşirme. Otherwise known as the child levy or the blood tax. Muslims could not be held as slaves, but Christians could. So Christian boys were recruited, at first by force and later on contribution, and they were made into soldier slaves. Sometimes they were also made into bureaucrats. So they converted to Islam, which is odd because they remained slaves. And that's not supposed to happen, but I guess they just made an exception. But it became an appealing career, a possible path to prominence and prestige. So now you have Christian families, donating a son to the Ottomans and hoping that, that kid will make good and, remember where he came from. So one problem with the system is that many of the key bureaucrats and key army leaders are not Turkish, for one thing. They're not Muslim by origin. And you have Ottoman Muslims who want access to these positions. Why can't we get in on this? So they actually stopped the Devşirme in 1648, but then the rulers tried to bring it back in 1703. So now you have this fight, which we've seen in other places, between modernizers and traditionalists. And the traditionalists want to go back to the glory days, make America great again, and go back to what worked for us in the 16th century. But it's not.
Yeah.
And then you have the issue of the Janissaries, so the elite troops, the standing army. Every time you have a new sultan who accedes to the throne, they want a bonus. And there's plenty of turnover in the role of sultan. So the Janissaries are getting big bonuses over and over again.
So they come to depend on that.
Yeah. So they're saying, where's our bonus? And they're pretty unhappy if they don't get one. Well, in the old days, that bonus came out of campaign loot. Our victorious armies are going to grab the money here and we're going to give you shares. But there have been no new conquests for some time. I think Abdul Hamid was in 1774 was the first sultan who didn't pay them. He just said, we don't have any money.
Yeah.
Turned out his pockets and said, sorry, can't pay. And that didn't go over well.
Yeah. Soldiers don't like not getting paid.
No. And into the 1800s, the Ottoman cavalry was still based on feudal cavalry levies, the Spahis. And you figured this out. I didn't even realize the connection.
Mm-hmm.
The root of the word.
Yeah, it's the Persian word for soldier is Sipahi. And it's basically sepoy, if you've listened to our episode in 1857 India, the word sepoy is a pretty important.
Yeah, it would be nice to do an episode on, contacts between these places that we never think of as being connected, but
well, yeah, you'll find the Afghanistan and Persia episodes to come.
That'll help a little bit. But I remember there were some Indian rulers who contacted the Sultan and said, "Hey, let's have an alliance against the East India Company. Let's fight against the British." And the Sultan had to say, "I'm sorry, I have my hands full with the Russians, the Austrians, the Egyptians, the Persians. I wish I could help you, but..."
So are you talking about Tipu Sultan in particular?
Yeah, I think so.
He wrote a lot of letters.
Yeah.
He did more than write letters, though.
Yeah. Another war in 1781 to 92. This is, again, Russia and Austria at the same time. The Ottomans lost the Crimea for good, made some small, very small gains against Austria. But they also lost Odessa and had to sign the Treaty of Jassy with Russia, a humiliating treaty. But it could have been much worse. They were, in fact, saved by the outbreak of the French Revolution. Catherine the Great decided that beating up on the Ottomans was not quite as important as keeping an eye on Poland and what was going on in France.
Yeah, and this whole reform issue is definitely coming to a head, and they're watching what's going on in France with the French Revolution. I think they probably heard about the American Revolution. So in 1789, Ottoman Sultan Selim III, he actually tries to, again, you know, this whole move of calling the notables together, giving them a bit of say to try to get some money out of them. So he holds a consultative assembly of 200 high officials, and he basically calls them to write a series of essays. It's like the Federalist Papers or something. A series of essays about how they can modernize, how to adapt their traditional values to modern methods, and military reform is a big deal. So this is where this initiative leads to the very controversial New Order Army, the Nizami Jadid. I think it's Jadid. I'm like, Jadid would be new in Arabic. I assume Jadid is how they say it in Turkish. They recruit. So they're changing the whole military system here. They're recruiting peasants and tribesmen. They're going to give them modern uniforms, modern weapons. So immediate reaction from the traditional military, the Janissaries, as you've mentioned. So they're not happy at all. And they've gotten pretty good at protecting their interests over the centuries. So the compromise, one of Selim's advisors looks for a compromise to say, okay, look, let's keep the Janissaries, let's keep them in place, let's keep them as our military as well, but let's modernize them too. So, let's teach them modern drill and modern weapons. And when it's time to drill, the Janissaries decide, no, we're not gonna march around in drill formation. No, thank you. That's not going to be our thing. So they riot on the drill parade, on the parade ground or whatever. Selim, meanwhile, as we mentioned, was trying to broker some kind of peace deal between the British and Tipu Sultan. He didn't want to join the alliance. Instead, he tried to broker a peace as if the British were going to be, didn't really understand what the British were after in India, I guess.
No.
He actually tried to talk Tipu out of fighting the British. He sent a letter to Tipu saying, "Listen, you can't trust the French or Napoleon."
Because they were invading Egypt at the time?
Yeah, because they were doing a little of the old invading of Egypt at the time. So the New Order Army, it's not a complete failure in the sense that the New Order Army in 1799 helps to defeat Napoleon's army. And it ends up, it's funny because in Syria, in Acre, there's a kind of a Mehmed Ali, we've talked about him. Mm-hmm. He kind of modernized, he was one of the early, he modernized before a lot of European countries, modernized Egypt. But there's a similar figure, Al-Jazar of Acre, and he kind of sets up an autonomous thing in Syria. And because of the financial and organizational situation, the Ottomans are not really in a position to remove him or impose their will on him any more than they could in Egypt. So,
but there's an example of not decline. Napoleon ran over everybody.
Yeah.
And then came up against Acre and couldn't take it.
Yeah.
And Al-Jazar led the defense. Okay, he got help from, you know, the British Navy, and they set up some guns, but that defense was, you know, Ottoman troops stopping Napoleon cold. At the same time, we have to admit that the relief army that came to help fought the French at the Battle of Mount Tabor. So this was General Kléber with 2,000 French soldiers against an army estimated at about 30,000 Ottomans. Mm-hmm. And the casualties were, the French lost 2, and the Ottoman casualties were measured in the thousands. Napoleon arrived with 2,000 more men, and the Ottoman army basically routed and retreated.
Uh-huh. So I wonder whether that was maybe not the new order. Maybe it was one of the older formations or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was the old style army. But defeats like these, this gives a real spur to the reform movement.
Yeah.
You know, we can't lose like this. This is really embarrassing.
And also the, you know, the centrifugal forces, is that right? The forces kind of pulling the empire apart. So you have Al-Jazar in Syria, you have Mehmet Ali in Egypt, you also have an Al-Daoud in Baghdad, who between 1764 and 1775 consolidates his own power until an Ottoman invasion force comes and kills him. But then they put in Suleiman Pasha, who governs Baghdad from 1780 to 1802. And that, you know, while they're pretty good with Sultan Selim, they're exercising more and more autonomy in those far-flung regions like Iraq, Syria, Egypt. And then we've got to mention Al-Wahhab.
As in Wahhabi.
Who's a preacher in Saudi Arabia. Well, not Saudi Arabia, the Arabian Peninsula. And he makes an alliance with one of these tribal leaders, Saud, Mohammed bin Saud, I think was his first name, Mohammed. And they start fighting the Ottoman governor in the Arabian Peninsula, Sharif Ghalib. And so Sharif Ghalib tries to suppress the Saudi and Wahhabi force. He's defeated in 1798. The Wahhabis take Karbala, which I think is in Iraq. They take Mecca in 1803. They sack Medina in 1805. They're driven out of Mecca, but then they recapture it in 1806. They are still there and shut the pilgrimage down in 1807. So the successor of Muhammad bin Saud, Abdelaziz, he actually substitutes his own name for that of the Sultan in Friday prayers. In Carolyn Finkel's words, the humiliation of Sultan Selim was complete. His claims to be supreme Islamic ruler now barely sustainable.
Selim had a rough time.
I'll get back to them in a couple of minutes.
Selim's doing all the things that you would think you would do if you were in charge. He's reforming the treasury. He's reforming the tax collection system. Oh, and he sent courtiers to European universities. You know, let's learn what they know. He could have been the Peter the Great of the Ottoman Empire. But then the Janissaries got upset. They had a major uprising in Edirne, Adrianople. And they marched on the capital, and Selim, he backed down. He couldn't face fighting them, and they basically dismantled all of his plans, and he was strangled in his own palace. And the reason given, failing to respect the religion of Islam and the traditions of the Ottomans. So the traditionalists win this round, and the reformers are shut down.
Yeah, it's like a lot of the early Chinese, you know, the Chinese story is similar, right?
Oh, yeah.
I see all these parallels.
Yeah. So Selim's brother, Mustafa IV, took over. He lasted about a year. And then Mahmud took over. And yeah, he's last man standing. But I just wanted to give a list of some of the problems going on at this time that are obviously going to interfere with any attempt to reform. 1803, the Maniot Rebellion. This is in the southern Peloponnese in Greece. And it's a very troublesome region for the Ottomans because you have rebellions again in 1807 and in 1815. These were the last areas basically controlled by Venice. So the Ottoman regime there is not as well established. There were pockets of Greece that they did not control until late in the 1700s. 1804 to 1813, major Serbian uprising. 1806 to 1812, war with Russia. Selim was actually quite encouraged by the news of Austerlitz, that the Austrians and Russians had been defeated by the French. But that war didn't go well. They were defeated on the Danube by Russian General Kutuzov. And even though they made some minor gains in the Caucasus, they let Russia make peace. Russia made peace in a hurry. The date 1812 gives you a clue because Napoleon was coming for them and they figured let's not fight on two fronts at the same time. 1807 to 1809, the Anglo-Turkish War. The British were worried about the Ottomans becoming too close to the French, so they insisted that Selim expel the French advisor Sebastiani. They also insisted that he declare war on France, cede the Danube to Russia, surrender his fleet and the Dardanelle force. This is pretty crazy stuff. Like stop the war against Russia and start a war against France. Meanwhile, give us your fleet. And are you shocked that Selim declined to agree to that? So he set up powerful shore batteries. The British sent a fleet into the Sea of Marmara and anchored opposite Constantinople. So the Ottomans set up some pretty powerful shore batteries and sank two British ships. So the British figured, okay, we can't hit you there. Then they went and captured Alexandria until they were forced to withdraw for much the same reasons as Napoleon was. So they signed a treaty, and this is the first instance of the idea that the Dardanelles, the passage between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean, should be demilitarized.
Mm-hmm.
The British agreed that no warships belonging to any power should enter the Dardanelles. And that's going to keep the Russians out of the Mediterranean, which will make the British happy. But it's a pretty good deal for Turkey if only the people who signed the deal would actually stick to it.
Yeah, I mean it's that's the British approach, right? It's like when you're supreme, it's a good time to declare that the world things are open. Everything should be open.
Yeah.
Benefits them. So let's go back to Arabia, where Sultan Mahmud, the so-called last man standing, he puts Muhammad Ali of Egypt in charge of recovering Arabia. So that's you want to get something done in that part of the world. Muhammad Ali is probably your guy. So in 1813, Muhammad Ali is successful in recovering Arabia. His own son, Ibrahim Pasha, is commander-in-chief. So Ibrahim Pasha captures Al-Diraya, the Saudi capital at the time, and razes it to the ground. He sends the Saudi Emir Abdullah bin Saud to Istanbul, where he is beheaded. And so that's the first round of Wahhabi. That's how the first round of Wahhabism in the Arabian Peninsula ends. But
it's a pretty bad sign for the Sultan that he can't, you know, punish these rebels and invaders without turning to another one of his slightly rebellious subordinates. And then he has more trouble. 1815 to 17, the Second Serbian Uprising. 1821, the Wallachian Uprising. That's Romania. And then, of course, 1821 to 32, the Greek War of Independence, which we covered in another episode. And the major naval defeat at Navarino in 1827. Even with the help of Muhammad Ali of Egypt, they couldn't win that. And yeah, I agree with you. There's also trouble going on in the Western Mediterranean where the Ottomans are losing control of Algeria, Tunisia eventually. But their authority over these far-flung territories is nominal.
Yeah.
Nominal at best.
Yeah, and then France starts colonizing Algeria in the 1830s, so that's the end of that part of the Ottoman province. So again, there's another round of reforms. These are called the Tanzimat. This is probably the most famous, and again, it becomes, even though it's not really successful or only partially successful, it becomes kind of like the rallying cry in Persia and Afghanistan and elsewhere too, that they, you know, they want to do this kind of reform. So this reordering, it happens after there's a big revolt of the Janissaries. Same issues, right? They don't want to be replaced by new order army. So the Janissaries actually barricaded themselves in the barracks, and they were crushed. The Sultan, I guess, you know, had ordered that cannons just opened fire on the barracks where they were barricaded. So they were either crushed inside, or when they came out, they were shot. The new order army was there to do it, as well as Sipahis and Istanbul mobs. So after this, the Janissaries were abolished. Their equipment was confiscated. The garrisons were expelled from all forts. The word Janissary was expunged.
Oh.
Thou shalt not speak the word Janissary. Many of them were expelled. Probably thousands were killed, and the new order army was the new army. There were also other reforms, again, that they were trying to do, including rationalizing government procedures and finance. But again, the power of the notables was impossible to break. So it always acted as a break, a limitation on reform.
I was surprised though, because at the same time, Mahmud revoked the privileges of the Spahis, and they went quietly. Maybe it was the example.
Janissary
of
example.
The Janissaries that helped. Yeah.
Anybody else got a problem?
Yeah. But that part went well. And then, of course, immediately thereafter, you have the 1828-29 war with Russia, and the Ottomans lost the mouth of the Danube, parts of Armenia, and Serbia became autonomous, nominally subject to the Sultan, but, you know, basically on their way to independence. 1831 to 32, the Bosnian Uprising. This was a reaction against reforms. The 1833 to 39 Albanian revolts, again, anti-reform, anti-centralist. Also, 1843 to 44 and 1847, more Albanian revolts. 1848, the Wallachian Uprising. 1848 is a little different. We did an episode on the...
Oh, yeah, it's part of the
revolutions in Europe. And this was one of them. It just happened to be against their Ottoman overlords rather than against a European. You can call the Ottomans a European power. But this was a liberal nationalist uprising. And that is a bad sign for a multinational, multi-ethnic empire. This is just the first, and it's going to get worse.
So in 1839, there's the Gulhane Edict, which Gulhane, I don't know how to pronounce it, And that's another round of the Tanzimat reforms. 1839 is an important year, mind you, because that's the Opium War. That's when, so I'm sure they were paying very close attention to that. And in the preamble of this edict, this so-called Gulhain Edict, it's just, you know, they describe a 150-year-long descent from greatness. So they, you know, to some extent, they were also on this decline hypothesis, even inside the Ottoman Empire. So here are some of the reforms they announce. Again, a lot of these were in the Tanzimat reforms, but they're announced again, re-announced. The replacement of tax farms with fair taxation, an equitable tax and conscription burden, bribery is outlawed. The penal code includes is replaced. Reformed. The poll tax is abolished. The poll tax being the tax that's paid by Christians and Jews for not being Muslims. Basically, it's called the jizya. It's a specific poll tax, which, you know, I guess the protectors, these external protectors of these communities, argued was discriminatory. It's part of Islamic law that they. Peoples of the book that are not Muslim, whether so Jews and Christians, they pay a tax, basically, this poll tax. The Gulhain Edict also attempts to create like the equivalent of a patriarch in the Jewish community. So the Armenian Christians have a patriarch. So they try to set up a similar thing with the Jewish community in the Ottoman Empire. But again, the edict is undermined by financial problems. They debase their coinage. You know, they can't get enough, I guess, precious metal to pull this off. There's a conservative backlash. And one perverse effect, which some observers have observed since, which is like the various secularizing reforms have this perverse effect where it makes the form of Islam that people practice a little bit more doctrinaire and less taken for granted. Because if you're saying, you're kind of making rules about where Islam is not allowed. And so the idea that it's like just an Islamic society and we're taking that for granted no longer applies. So people start thinking about their religion in a little bit more of a defensive way. Which kind of I don't want to use the word radicalizes, but it kind of it makes
the clergy start to defend their position, afraid of what's coming next.
Yeah, so they're defending it against other religions. They're defending it against secularization in their own society, which they see, happening. Meanwhile, this whole question of protecting these communities. After Western Europe expelled Jews and minorities, Jews and Muslims, hundreds of years before, they're very keen to protect Christians and Jews. So Britain sets itself up as the protector of the Jews in the Ottoman Empire. Russia is the Orthodox Christians, and France is the protector of the Catholics. So I'm sure that the religious communities in the Ottoman Empire felt very, very well protected by the fact that these powers were now representing them.
Yeah, no, it basically blew up into the Crimean War, and that was what it was all about. So we covered that in a previous episode. The Russians used this excuse to launch their invasion along the Danube, and Britain and France came in to stop them from expanding at the Ottoman expense. They certainly did not want Constantinople in Russian hands. So as we saw in that war, the Russians were actually defeated by the Ottomans along the Danube. The Ottomans also participated in the invasion of the Crimea and the siege of Sevastopol and so on. And they won. So the Ottomans figured, well, we won this war. They would have liked to regain some of the Black Sea coastline adjacent to Armenia. But Britain and France vetoed that. So the only result of the war was that Russia had to demilitarize the Black Sea. That's it. Kind of a burn for the Ottomans if, you know, after all that effort. Yeah. But their troubles didn't end. They were simultaneously in a war with Serbia that lasted from 1852 to 1878. Then the 1852 to 62 uprising in Herzegovina, the 1853-4 war with Montenegro. And I guess this is just business as usual because, you know, right after the Crimean War, Abdülmecid announced the Islahat Fermani, which was a new reform meant to carry on or to enhance the Tanzimat of 1839. First step, reform the tax system again. So he came up with a flat tax. He changed from a flat tax to a tax proportionate to wealth.
Progressive.
Yeah, progressive and obviously tax. Not going to be popular with the wealthy upper classes. Conscription for the army. Non-Muslims were given the choice of joining the army or paying the tax. And he also began a policy called Ottomanism. I guess trying to group all his reforms under a catchphrase or a label that would maybe gain some support. So he promised guaranteed rights for all subjects of the empire, regardless of ethnicity or religion, which is an interesting answer to nationalism. Maybe he saw, you know, the coming problems and was trying to come up with some answer to them. Yeah. He was the first sultan to tour the empire. And apparently he met with, you know, average people and listened to their concerns. Established a new currency, the Ottoman lira. I have no idea why they chose that name for it. Abolished the slave markets. He was considering building a railway to Mecca. This would have helped pilgrims on the Hajj. Unfortunately, Abdülmecid is also well known for not curbing his own private spending. He built himself a new modern palace. This is the Dolmabahçe, which is considered it's not a monstrosity. It's more considered a huge white elephant, famous for all of the enormous crystal chandeliers inside. And I'm not sure this is directly connected, but sometime in this period, a little fashion change seemed to reflect that, you know, reform was gaining the upper hand. The fez began to replace the turban.
Yeah, I read about that. That was explicitly part of their modernization.
Yeah, it's pretty significant. Pretty significant. But their troubles carry on. 1859 riots in Lebanon, they spread into Syria, and you ended up with a full-scale war between Muslims, Christians, and Druze. This wasn't the Ottomans starting anything. They actually came in to try to mediate, but it got to the level of, reciprocal massacres, churches and villages being destroyed. So now you have to step in and try to stop the fighting between three different groups. Good luck with that. The next sultan, Abdul Aziz, in 1861, he became the first sultan to travel outside the empire and meet other world leaders, not on the battlefield, but, you know, in chambers. This is the sultan who visited Victoria. She wasn't too thrilled, but she comforted herself with the thought that the sultan is not likely to come again. So this is a one-time thing. I can put up with it. He also went to France, Prussia, and Austria, and he came home just eager to make some more modernization happen. He had all kinds of ideas, postage stamps for mail. We're going to build railways. And yeah, didn't work out that way.
Yeah. And you know, in from 1859 to 1869, they're building the Suez Canal, which is a major change to the importance of the Ottoman Empire in the global trade circuit. It's a huge reduction in their strategic position.
Yeah.
I was reading about this because of the Suez, you know, that ship that got stuck in there over the past couple of weeks. And there was a Twitter feed that I follow, Laith Marouf. He's a, he's from somewhere in Syria, Lebanon, that part of the world, Palestine. And I was looking at his tweet. He estimated that 250,000 people died building that Suez Canal. Nasser, the third world leader who we'll talk about in the next series, who became the leader of independent Egypt, the president of independent Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, he estimated 130,000. The population of Egypt was 4 million, and the estimates are that 1 million of those 4 million were forced into labor to build the Suez Canal. So if you want to know what the scale of that project was, and the sacrifice that the people of Egypt, you know, made to make that happen, that's what it was. So we're also going to hear more about this character, Khedive Ismail, who I guess was one of the successors of Mehmed Ali. I don't know how many generations later, but he was also, you know, continued this modernizing project and had an idea to get in on the imperial, you know, like Japan, right? Like the way Japan thought, if you can't beat them, join them. I think Khedive Ismail had a similar idea. So he wanted to extend an empire for Egypt into Africa. Why can't we have an African empire as well? But he came into conflict with a equally strong-willed character, otherwise known as the Mahdi, in 1881, who basically annihilated Khedive Ismail's army. So that kind of dashed Egypt's dreams of an African empire. But back to our Ottoman story, perhaps not coincidentally, 2 years after the completion of the Suez Canal in 1871, the Ottoman Empire's finances are officially in ruins. By 1873, there's a famine all across Anatolia. This is the same period of famine in India and China, remember? And as I'll tell you in the next episode, there's also an immense famine in the Persian Empire at the same time that I had no idea about until I read this book, but more about that next episode. So by 1875, there are tax revolts because of this economic situation. Nobody has any money to pay taxes. So as often happens in these kinds of crises, there's another attempt at modernization. They try to create a constitutional reform. So they declare a constitution. One of these reformers, Medhat Pasha, who's synonymous with reform, I guess, in the Ottoman Empire. Local councils, there's extension of credit at the local level, newspapers, schools, the closing of the slave trade. And some people think, well, if you're closing the slave trade, are you going to close the harem, the institution of the harem as well? But that apparently persists for some more time.
Well, yeah, because it's not what most Western people imagine or fantasize about. It's the living quarters of all the female members of the family.
Yeah.
Like, yes, the concubines too, but it's really a place to live for all the all your female relatives.
Right.
It's also the origin of an awful lot of plotting and scheming centered around who's going to occupy the throne. So Abdul Aziz died in 1876. I couldn't figure out whether it was suicide or a palace coup. But given the reaction of his successor, my guess would be on the coup. Murad V, when he heard that he was going to become the next sultan, apparently he vomited. And when they were girding him with the sword of Osman, apparently he cried. So I don't think he wanted the job, and he didn't last very long. And this is another problem, which is often emphasized in Western accounts, is the palace intrigues and the putting unfit successors on the throne so that they can be manipulated by, you know, the palace intrigue club. And
yeah, it's terrible. They needed to have a democratic system like ours that puts the best people, you know, in charge, like Doug Ford here.
I wouldn't go that far, but no, it's all about, you know, how you're interpreting things. And they're attributing the sick man's problems to internal affairs like these palace intrigues. Whereas, how about the fact that they are constantly being attacked on multiple fronts? So this leads to the big war, 1877. It starts over the issue of Bulgaria, Ottoman province, which the Russians are eyeing. So the war starts with Russia over the issue of Bulgaria. The Russians are joined by the Romanians and some Bulgarian rebels, and they besiege Plevna. And the siege of Plevna lasts for months, which buys time for the Sultan to respond. By this time, the Ottoman troops are better armed. They have rifles. They have Martini Henry rifles. They're single shot, but the rate of fire and the accuracy and the range is considerably better. But to add to Ottoman troubles, Serbia and Montenegro both decide that this would be a good time to join in. So it's a rather confused war. Both sides are committing massacres, and it's a very bad time to be a Muslim in Bulgaria or a Jew. There's an exodus of Bulgarian Muslims and Jews to avoid being slaughtered.
Right. So the Ottomans lose. The Treaty of San Stefano is like one of those unequal treaties that we're used to from this period. And at this point, you know, to summarize, I think Carolyn Finkel puts it, the Ottoman Empire lost more than a third of its territory and much of its non-Muslim population.
Yeah, and this caught the attention of the other European powers. It didn't last all that long, so they didn't have time to intervene. Plus, they had their own things going on, I suppose. But they were concerned about Russian expansion, and they were also concerned about what looked like the Ottoman Empire possibly crumbling. Yeah. So they called a Congress, the Congress of Berlin, in 1878. So we're back to the Congress system. If you remember, after the French Revolution, the big powers get together, redraw the map, work out some of their issues. And Bismarck offered to host, and he acted as the honest broker. He basically said, Germany doesn't want anything. We're not asking for anything. but we would like to resolve all of these, you know, these perennial Balkan conflicts. This is the era when the Balkans really gets its bad reputation, because there seems to be a war going on in three or four places at once all of the time. So the goals of this Congress are to maintain what's left of the Ottoman Empire, somehow limit Russian gains, and then balance competing interests in the region to prevent a future conflict. Because Bismarck can already see one of these problems is going to, you know, get out of control, and it's going to drag in Austria as well as Russia. And that would be very bad for Germany because of issues which I guess we'll get to eventually. It's foreshadowing World War I already, which, you know, Bismarck had a feeling that, you know, it's going to start with some damn stupidity in the Balkans that is going to drag us in. So he's trying to solve this now. So the Russians, after their great success, they get Kars and Batum. These are in the Caucasus. Romania gets northern Dobruja, but they have to cede Bessarabia to Russia in order to get it. Serbia, Montenegro, and Romania are officially declared independent of the Ottoman Empire, which, you know, considering how often they were at war with the Sultan, that's probably a good thing. Bulgaria gains autonomous government, which is what Serbia, Montenegro, and Romania had. That leaves the territory of Bosnia-Herzegovina physically cut off from the rest of the Ottoman Empire. It's now quite far from the remaining Ottoman territories in Macedonia. So given the distance, it's put under Austro-Hungarian administrative control. This is a really unusual way of settling things that I had not seen before. So Austria is going to administer the Ottoman province of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And the Austrians also get a little piece of territory called the Sanjak of Novi Pazar, which it's the only time in history you're really going to hear it mentioned, but it will become a cause célèbre, a bit of an issue in international politics. And then just to round off all the gains, Britain gets Cyprus. What does that have to do with, well, we're sharing out the pie, so here's your slice. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And like most, parties where you share out the pie, most of the participants were unhappy. We didn't get enough. They got a bigger piece than we did. We wanted that. And the grievances from this Congress, they just sat there and festered and led, I would say, directly to renewed war in the Balkans in 1912 and 13. And of course, you could argue that they led to the First World War. So the unhappy parties, Serbia, Bulgaria, and Greece, most of all, complaining that they hadn't got as much as they deserved. And of course, Russia, humiliated. They won the war. You know, you call a Congress and take away most of the territory that we thought we should gain. And then Austria gained a whole bunch without doing anything. And here's the beginning of, you know, tensions in Bosnia and Herzegovina and all these things that we're quite familiar with.
These Congresses are so bad.
Well, yeah, I mean, once you know what they're for, you can't really be surprised at the results.
Yeah.
You know. So for the Ottomans, this was another, humiliating defeat. And as you said, they lost a huge chunk of territory, even if much of it was only under nominal control. It's still quite humiliating and a shock to the system. So this led to the Young Ottomans movement. And they seem to be wanting to push the reform further and faster, you know, before we lose everything. They demanded a constitution. They actually started drafting a constitution. They wanted a bicameral parliament. This would be a two-chamber government, like a House of Lords and a parliament, or like a Senate and a Congress. But the Sultan didn't like their ideas, and in 1878, he killed the plans for a new constitution. Maybe he was distracted. I don't know. In the 1890s, he had to deal with a Russian-backed uprising in Armenia. They responded with massacres. Abdul Hamid II got his nickname, the Red Sultan, from this. First example I can think of a, what you call terrorism now, 10 Armenian revolutionaries seized the Ottoman National Bank in Istanbul.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But that, yes, it attracted attention to their cause, but it also led to, massacres and reprisal. 1897, war with Greece, uprising in Crete. The Greeks tried to intervene and help the Cretan uprising, European powers intervened. Egypt tried to help the Sultan, but there was an international squadron hovering off Crete from 1897 to 1898. Basically, the Greeks tried a snatch and grab. They thought if they struck quickly that they could make gains at the Ottoman expense, but their army was poorly prepared and they were heavily defeated. And that despite the help of Ricciotti Garibaldi.
I know that name.
Yeah, the son of your your friend. So the Greeks lost the war rather badly, and the great powers intervened again to prevent, I don't know what, but stop the fighting now. And the Greeks had to make some minor gains along the border and pay an indemnity. So, you know, an Ottoman victory, and they're stopped from making any profit from it because we don't want to, you know, upset the balance here. So the Ottomans at this stage, I think, realized that they needed an ally. You know, we're always fighting two or three people at once. Maybe we should, you know, find a friend. And it's not too surprising that they turned to Germany. Yes. Right? This is, first of all, one of the greatest powers of the day. And second of all, a country that has never come and, you know, taken things from us.
Yeah.
You have a reason, a very good reason, not to trust the British. The French have let you down multiple times. Obviously, you're not going to turn to the Russians. Germany. German financiers, military advisors, engineers invited to come in and help. And this is the origin of the Berlin to Baghdad railway.
Right. So you can see we can start to see the pieces of the puzzle of World War One kind of snapping into place here.
Yeah. But this, this is going to alarm the Russians, and it's going to make the British very worried. They don't like the idea of, you know, the Germans having, you know, such a long reach, you know, Baghdad, that's a little too close to our new canal. And Kaiser Wilhelm visited the Ottomans twice. So the relationship was getting pretty darn close. But that doesn't stop the movement for reform. There was an assassination attempt on Abdulhamid in 1905. And then, of course, the very, very, very famous Young Turks movement, which started in 1908. And it's a major change away from Ottomanism. We're going to come up with Turkish nationalism. So we're going to fight nationalism with nationalism.
And it's fascinating because, you know, while Ottomanism led to these horrific massacres of Armenians in the 1890s, it's not until nationalism that you get the Armenian genocide in 1915, which again, you'll have to wait for our next series to talk about.
So if you're studying the history of the Ottoman Empire, yes, there was decline. I think we're both admitting that. Mm-hmm. Not consistent. You know, it's not a straight line down. But you still have to work out, you know, why? What happened? Was it internal issues? Was it their outdated systems? Was it the resistance of traditionalists to reform? Or the fact that many of the attempts at reform were limited or unsuccessful. Whereas I'm tempted to look more at external issues.
Yeah.
How do you survive with an empire that big? How do you simultaneously defend the Caucasus, the Danube, Iraq, Mediterranean islands? I can't think of an empire that could handle.
Yeah, it's like it's just simply built into the success that you're going to fail in that sense.
Yeah.
More borders, more problems.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Which is also at this period, there's a whole theory, I guess, that the British develop about why their empire is the best. you'll be shocked that they've developed it. But they argue that, you know, naval empires that maintain kind of coastal, you know, power over coasts and strategic centers on coasts are
really
easier.
They didn't go for the racial argument?
Well, yeah, they had that too. Yeah. We're racially better at sailing ships.
Yeah, this is the era of nationalism. So, of course, many of the studies of the period are going to focus on that. And they're going to say that, you know, the Ottoman Empire is simply an outdated idea. You can't have a multi-ethnic empire surviving against the, as you say, centrifugal force of, you know, your distant provinces spinning away.
Yeah.
What I find most interesting is that Ottoman tolerance lasted as long as it did. Right. Yes, there were massacres. We saw that in the Greek War of Independence and in other places. But those are, I'm not excusing them. I'm simply explaining them. They're in reprisal for revolt and uprising.
Yeah. It always happens
in
counterinsurgencies. Yeah.
And then my final note, it's interesting that the Ottoman decline is so well documented, considering that they lasted longer than the Romanovs in Russia.
Yeah.
And just as long as the Habsburgs.
Right. Wow. All right. Well, there are many pieces on this interlocking geographical board, but certainly one of the important borders of the Ottoman Empire was with the Persians.
Is that where we're going next?
It is to the Persian Empire that we turn next.